Good afternoon. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Sleater, Judge Klapacki, the Honorable Carol Hooten presiding.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on our calendar this afternoon is MCHS Red Wing versus Brittany in Converse. The file number is A201001. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please introduce yourself and identify your client when you commence your oral arguments. The appellant may proceed at this time.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Chris Wilcox. I represent Brittany Converse, the appellant in this case. This case involves a collection action on an alleged medical debt that resulted in the entry of judgment against my client on claims of breach of contract and unjust enrichment. There are fundamentally two matters on appeal. The lower court's order denying my client's motion to dismiss based on rule 5.04 for failure to file within 1 year of commencement, and the lower court's grant of summary judgment for the plaintiffs. Converse asked this court to reverse the lower court's order denying my client's rule 504 motion, and in the alternative, Converse asked this court to reverse the lower court's order granting plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. The lower court should be reversed for three reasons. First, because Converse waived service of process with service over answer pursuant to Rule 12, an action was commenced and not timely filed with the court as required by Rule 504. Second, plaintiff failed to meet its burden under Rule 56 to demonstrate that there were no material facts in dispute, precluding entry of summary judgment. And third, the court incorrectly and simultaneously entered judgment on plaintiff's unjust enrichment claim in spite of a finding of an express contract and without undertaking any analysis as to the extent of the benefit retained by Converse, the reasonable value of the benefit conferred. The underlying facts of the case are—
And Mr. Wilcox, could I just inquire, are you aware of any case law that would define commencement of the action any different than Rule 301 does, which would be service by a plaintiff of defendant, which satisfies the rules?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case law that expressly defines commencement of the case differently than the rule does.
So my question, since we're really the focus is Rule 504, that was the motion for dismissal, and that requires commencement and a timeline from commencement. If there is no case law that would otherwise interpret commencement to include service by the defendant of the plaintiff, wouldn't that end the analysis and our review that the court properly denied motion for dismissal under 504?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, Rule 504 just refers you to Rule 405, which outlines the procedure for either service of process personally or service by mail with return of a waiver form. And there's some issues about which version of Rule 405 applied, but either way, you know, under Rule 405, it would have required return of an acknowledgement form or a waiver of service. And the reason I don't think that resolves the issue is because cases that determine when waiver occurs under Rule 12, implicitly acknowledge that a case has been commenced. There's Rule 12.08 is clear that any defense based on insufficiency of service of process is waived by failing to include it in the answer. And so the question for this court is, if waiver is sufficient under Rule 12, why wouldn't it be sufficient for purposes of Rule 405 and 5.04?
Mr. Wilcox, are you familiar with the purpose of and the adoption of Rule 504?
Yes, Your Honor. Do you want me to get into
it? Well, I happen to have been on the committee that it involved in adoption of that rule, and I recall the reason for the rule is that court administrators wanted to see cases filed and so they could clear calendars and not have Minnesota be an outlier where you could start a suit and never file a summons and complaint. And so the committee and Supreme Court adopted 504 to keep Minnesota's procedure where you didn't have to file the summons and complaint before you served, which is what most states require, and use our old system, but put a 1-year time lapse so that cases didn't stick out there forever and ever. Well, I'm wondering whether the purpose of that rule has any impact on how we might interpret it.
I don't think it does, Your Honor. And the reason is because I think we're still—
Well, the reason I'm suggesting that maybe in your favor, that it might be in your favor to say, well, an answer means that everybody knows there's a lawsuit and you start counting then instead of waiting for another year. The opposite interpretation that we're cutting against the purpose of rule to have things filed and resolved.
Yeah, I agree with what you said, Your Honor. I think there's some issues with the purpose, particularly in this case, where not only did the defendants serve an answer, but there was also follow-up communications indicating that, you know, look, I know there was no acknowledgement of service form sent along with the answer. We'll execute a waiver outside of the strictures of 405 and its time requirements, explicitly indicating that we consent to jurisdiction and there's no reason we shouldn't proceed with the case. So, I think the purpose behind 504 is effectuated better by finding that a Rule 12 waiver is sufficient. I also think that a Rule 405, if you look at the underlying purpose of that rule, is also better effectuated by finding that a Rule 12 waiver is sufficient. And the reason for that is, as the respondents note, the reason for the strictures in 405 are that we want to shift the costs of service to uncooperative defendants. And I fully agree that that's the way the rule should be interpreted. But here you have a cooperative defendant who is explicitly saying the court has jurisdiction and we waive any affirmative defense based on insufficiency of service of process. And we'll do whatever it takes for you to get that waiver memorialized. And we have the plaintiff imposing costs on the defendant by requiring them to answer another complaint, which in this instance was a different complaint in terms of the amounts being requested. We would have been required to execute a waiver based on the new complaint. And that to me seems to fundamentally go against the underlying purpose of Rule 4.05. And what I would add is, you know, my client's position, you know, we acknowledge that in general, the plain meaning rule applies to interpretation of the rules of civil procedure, just as it does in determining statutes. But when we read statutes and we apply the plain meaning rule, we don't read the specific provision in isolation. We look to other portions of the statute. Here we're asking the court to look to Rule 12, and as the court notes, the underlying purpose of 5.04. And if there's any ambiguity there, or if a plain meaning reading of Rule 4.05 results in absurdity, I think the court has to resolve the ambiguity or resolve the absurdity. And here I think there's ambiguity in the sense that, you know, it's not clear in the rules why a waiver under Rule 12 would be insufficient for Rule 405. And we have the absurd result where the underlying purposes of both 5.04 and 4.05 are directly contrary to the way the lower court interpreted it here. So I won't focus any more on those issues. And I'll move on to the summary judgment issues, unless the court has further questions. But what I would say about the summary judgment order that was entered is that, you know, from the outset of this case, my client's position has not been that, you know, the plaintiff is not entitled to any repayment. The issue has been over whether they're entitled to reasonable amounts and whether those reasonable amounts are accurately reflected in the complaint and in the amounts being demanded by plaintiff. So I acknowledge some discovery issues that occurred prior to the court's entry of summary judgment. In responding to summary judgment, I raised those issues with the court in a Rule 56 affidavit requesting additional time to conduct discovery.
Can I ask you some questions about that? Because, you know, one thing that that I didn't realize until I read page 4 of the respondent's brief is that your client was insured under a health insurance policy. Am I correct?
That's not exactly correct, Your Honor. It's not insurance in the way we would traditionally think about insurance. Her employer has coverage through a reference-based pricing plan. And so it's a little bit different from insurance in terms of how it operates.
Well, but it's apparently it's referred to as a health insurer, and they basically have a deductible and some things are covered and some aren't, and it operates as an insurance policy or the way an insurance policy would, doesn't it?
Well, it operates a little differently in that the plan effectively sets a cap for amounts it will pay at a percentage above the amount that the hospital charges to Medicare patients. And so it's a little different in terms of the way it operates.
Well, and as I look at the respondent's brief, there's an indication that at least almost half of this amount is for a deductible under this plan, isn't it? It's her agreed upon deductible with her health insurer.
There is an issue there. That's correct.
And the other issues are apparently the insurance policy said there wasn't any, I think one was a coordination of benefits. The other was an issue with the benefits were exhausted under the plan.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
All right. So to the extent then that so there's been already some type of negotiation between this plan or whatever you want to call it, this insurance plan and the medical providers. Am I correct?
There's negotiations. I don't recall whether or not any agreement was reached between the...
Well, no, I'm talking about is any insurance plan that, you know, there's usually some agreements between that plan and the medical providers as to what the plan will pay and not pay.
Yes, and that's correct.
All right. So I don't think it's, I mean, you make a big argument about how she didn't receive any of the benefits of of a negotiated health insurance plan in this case, whereas when I look at the facts, she does have a health insurance plan that there would have been. I mean, this is a little different than someone just walking in off the street with no insurance. Isn't that true?
Well, it's slightly different, but if you look at my understanding of the rates that are being applied by the hospital here is that they're charge master rates and not rates separately negotiated with the plan.
Well, but is there anything that you've shown? I mean, has there been any showing? I mean, because we have an agreement where your client agrees to pay all charges not covered by your health insurance. And I assume some of the charges were covered by the health insurance. Am I correct?
In this instance, no. My recollection is that no amounts were paid for these services under her plan.
Okay. So isn't her problem really with her plan rather than this medical provider? Because there's no dispute that all these services were provided. Am I correct?
Well, that there very well may be a problem with the plan as well. But the fact of the matter is that under the plan, she's responsible for this balance billing. And so the issue is, if that's the case, does the hospital's charges for services still need to meet Minnesota law's requirement that they be customary and reasonable? And so I don't think the fact that she had this plan that didn't cover certain amounts, whether they were required to or not, ultimately addresses the issue of whether or not the hospital was entitled to what they were claiming.
All right. Do you agree that this agreement that she reached with the hospital or the clinic here was governed by Minnesota Statute 62J 81 through 83?
I don't recall the site off the top of my head. I apologize, Your Honor.
All right. Well, it was cited in respondent's brief on page 22, which basically gives it's a statute that gives the right of the consumer to ask for those charges, and the hospital is required upon being asked to provide that information.
Okay. I recall what the statute you're referencing now. I mean, I think the issue with that is a right to request information doesn't mean that a contract concerning the same subject matter includes a definite term. And so one case that was cited by the respondents in the lower court was a South Dakota court case that effectively said, well, it's sufficient if you include a link to the hospital's charge master rates in the acknowledgement of service or in the acknowledgement of financial responsibility. And so, you know, it may be that's sufficient to incorporate those rates into a contract, but absent that, I'm not sure that the statutory right to request those rates otherwise alters the analysis of the contract.
Well, it also requires the clinic and hospital to have a website with the prices. That's also required.
Yes, and that's exactly what was provided to the consumer in the acknowledgement of financial responsibility form in the South Dakota case that was cited.
But here in this state, it's a requirement that these be made available and they're publicly made available.
Yeah, I'm acknowledging that it's publicly available. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? I think your time is, I think you've actually gone over a few minutes, but.
Yeah, my apologies. No.
No, it's not your fault. It's my fault. I was asking the questions. So any judges have any other questions? All right. Very good. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
The respondent may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I am Gregory Hansen, and I represent the respondent, Mayo Clinic Health System, Red Wing. This appeal is about the district court's application of the rules of civil procedure to the facts of this case, and Mayo's respectfully asking that the district court affirm the decisions of the lower court. But the heart of this issue is very simple. The dispute arose from healthcare goods and services rendered that Mayo is simply trying to recover compensation for and has not received that. Now, suing a patient, a former patient, is an extraordinary action for Mayo and one that it only pursues as a last resort. But as the record reflects, Ms. Converse has resisted Mayo's attempts to try and resolve this matter reasonably up until this point.
Well, can I ask you, I mean, just factually, is it true that the insurance paid nothing on this case?
That is correct, Your Honor. Insurance paid nothing towards the amounts that were billed to insurance. There was a contractual adjustment, as Your Honor noted, of roughly about $900 in terms of a discount that she received. But as Your Honor noted, there were various reasons provided by the insurer for denial of payment, mostly attributed to deductible or exhausted benefits, coordination of benefits, those types of things.
I ask you first about the procedural issue? Because I mean, it does seem to that we have conflicting rules. I mean, in terms of we've got a case where the rule clearly states under 4.05, that if the acknowledgement of service under this rule is not received by the sender within the time defendant is required by these rules to serve an answer, service shall be ineffectual. But then we also have the other rule and we have our case law that says if you provide an answer and participate in the litigation, you waived any ineffective service of process issue. How do we reconcile those conflicting body of the law?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that and the briefs both acknowledge that the rules can't be read in isolation. You kind of have to look at everything put together. And Your Honor correctly notes that there's this time element that's important to Rule 4.05 and thus Rule 3.01. And, you know, Ms. Converse's argument that her answer that was turned over to Mayo 40 days after the mailed service of the summons and complaint, is an acknowledgement of service and that would be effective.
That took effect in May of 2018, correct?
Yes, correct. May 3rd or May 2nd of 2018. And that untimely acknowledgement ignores and the invocation of 12.08 ignores that time requirement under 12.01. That answer was due 20 days after the complaint was served. And
but so, if we're looking at the purposes of Rule 504, that once you start getting involved with the court, we want these things filed and filed within a year. You took a good year and a half or better, did you not, from when you attempted to involve the court with that original summons before you served that final summons and complaint and had proper service. My question is, under these circumstances, why shouldn't Rule 504 require you to file your pleadings within the 1 year from when you start to try to involve the court in this matter, which was when you sent that first summons and complaint out, instead of giving you a year and a half or almost 2 years?
Yeah, so Your Honor, the personal service of the summons complaint was effected on June 5th of 2019. And as Your Honor notes, the response to the summons and complaint that was mailed was received in May of 2018. So if we're talking maybe about a year, that's what we're talking about. But to your point about the court process and getting the court involved, I think that the rules exist, the rules in Minnesota in particular, with respect to mailed service of pleadings or pocket service of pleadings, such that the parties, it allows the parties an opportunity to assert their claims against opposing parties and potentially resolve the dispute before the involvement of the court. And that would have been Mayo's preference here. And Mayo communicated with Ms. Converse to try and effectuate that prior to ultimately defending the motion to dismiss and serving its complaint.
But the fact remains that you started this matter in March of 2018. There's an answer in May of 2018, and then nothing happens until June of 2019, right?
Nothing in terms of affecting service of process, correct?
Nothing happens. And the Rule 504 contemplates that we want these matters filed promptly, and if you don't file them promptly within 1 year, you know what the result is.
I understand, Your Honor. It's been Mayo's position that throughout this matter that service was not effective, and therefore the filing requirement was inapplicable. And if it were to be found that the 5.04 bar exists, it would have prejudiced Mayo as it relates to valid claims that for the amounts that's owed. And
well, you could always amend the complaint. That's
yes,
not a bar.
Yes, Your Honor, and that occurred here. And
I mean, the reality is in May of 2018, you knew that the defendant had a lawyer and had submitted an answer, and you could start at the gun, work on that, discovery, whatever you wanted to do. You could amend the complaint, but you did nothing for another year plus. That, to me, runs right in the face of the purpose of why we have Rule 504.
I see, Your Honor, and I would only offer that while pleadings did not exchange until that June 5th date, certainly there were communications with counsel about potentially trying to resolve the dispute. Now, ultimately, those did not resolve any dispute, and you know that's been a pattern throughout this matter.
To keep you from filing that summons and complaint within 1 year of that answer?
What kept the plaintiff from filing its summons and complaint was ineffective service of process.
Well, but that had been waived by the answer, so that you could have filed the summons and complaint, could have filed the answer, and you could have promptly had this matter in the court.
And I accept that, Your Honor, but still would say that acknowledgement in the answer, waiving a defense would have still required that pleading to have been served timely in order for that to be effective. So, you know, that's been plaintiff's position throughout these proceedings and, you know, including the arguments, like I said, with respect to prejudice of its claims that were presented to the court on Ms. Converse's motion to dismiss. And Your Honors, I would just only add that, as the case proceeded beyond that motion, beyond subsequent amending of the pleadings to include additional dates of service and amounts that were unpaid. And that's worth noting because again, you know, this pattern, you know, continued for Ms. Converse of not paying Mayo for the amounts that were owed. And it kind of highlights the extreme circumstances we have here where Mayo is forced to, you know, continue with this litigation. And as Your Honor knows,
can I ask you this question? Was there discovery done between May 2nd, 2018, when there was arguably a waiver of the service of process by the answer, and May 30th, 2019, when this motion to dismiss was brought?
Yes, Your Honor. Ms. Converse did serve discovery, and you know, Mayo's position was that those requests were received and contemplated, but that because service of process was ineffective and because no lawsuit had been commenced, that those requests were premature and that any discovery between the parties ought take place informally to try and resolve the dispute. And so discovery was engaged informally to talk about the amounts, to talk about the and disclose relevant dates of service and those types of things. There were some delays, and that's not unusual in a matter like this where an authorization is required from the patient to be able to turn over unredacted copies. But ultimately those were produced and every response to her discovery was responded to. No additional discovery was propounded. And to your point, Your Honor, no discovery was directed to this health insurance plan. And I suppose, you know, that leads us to summary judgment. Unless the judges have any further questions about commencement.
Mr. Hansen, I was going to jump to that summary judgment issue. It seems from your briefing, you do acknowledge there's no special Minnesota precedent that would allow for, at least as it applies to the rates portion of a contract, for a medical exception. And so essentially, and I think you acknowledge as well that there was no reference to the rate schedule in the acknowledgement as well. And so my question is, on what basis would there be, at least for summary judgment purposes, no genuine issue material fact that a contract had been formed? And I'm thinking of the analogy of a lawyer who agrees to do legal services and says, and then you sign a document simply saying, I'll pay for the services, but there's no identification of an hourly rate, what those services are. I assume you would concede there would be no, at least for summary judgment purposes, until there was facts elaborated and at a trial, that there was a breach. There'd be a contract that could be breached. And I'm just trying to wonder how that this could be distinguished from that if there's no case law in Minnesota to direct us in that regard.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the difference itself is highlighted with the cases in Mayo's brief that, you know, healthcare is different than the practice of law. It may be sufficient for me to state an hourly rate that I would charge a client and for them to agree that any work I perform will be subject to that rate. But in the healthcare—
Can I just confirm though, when you say cases, that's why I wanted to start off with a question. There are no Minnesota cases to direct us. So wouldn't it be true we are left with general contract common law in Minnesota to apply?
Your Honor, yes. And I think that the outside cases, the cases from, the majority of cases that have looked at this issue have been mounting in their majority in support of the idea that there is no other logical conclusion from Mayo's contract that says all charges, that refers to anything other than their usual and customary charges. And the evidence that those charges were usual and customary was put before the court in summary judgment, specifically that no evidence was introduced by Ms. Converse to rebut that claim by the Mayo Clinic. But in addition to that, the insurance company processed these claims, and insurers are not in the business of processing and paying claims that are not usual and customary rates. And none of the denials—
Can I just follow up with that thing? I'm sorry, I interrupted you. That sounds essentially like the cause of action, which I think you might agree the court improperly granted because it had already ruled in favor of your client on the breach of contract. But that sounds like a traditional unjust enrichment. In other words, the value of the services, and then you would present evidence at that trial of the reasonable and customary services when there's been no agreement as to it. That's why you would plead it. Strikes me that in most of our medical area, unpaid bills like this would be solely an unjust enrichment. Am I mistaken in terms of case law?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that there is a precedent. It's just precedent from other states, as this is an issue of first impression for Minnesota to consider. So, you know, a contract between a patient and a healthcare provider is just, a bilateral contract, an agreement for, Mayo to perform the care and for Ms. Converse to pay for the care. And
so is it, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Finish your sentence, please.
Oh, just only that contract in and of itself is sufficient and would be sufficient under Minnesota case law as an implied contract. But here we have a written document that's been.
Let me ask you about the contract. I noticed that there are only three authorizations signed, and yet there were services rendered on 19 different dates. So is it your view that the very first authorization covered all 19 and then you didn't need the other two or should there be an authorization for every time a service is rendered? What's your view on that?
Yes, Your Honor. Mayo's position as it relates to the authorization and service terms contract is that the service terms contract that was signed in August of 2015 is the contract.
That's the first one?
Yes, Your Honor. And the subsequent... I was just going to answer by saying that the subsequent contracts that were signed by Ms. Converse are just further affirmation of her promise to pay and agreement to be bound by the terms that the parties agreed to initially.
I have one question, and I want to go back to the procedural question. If we determine as a matter of law that by virtue of the answer, there was a waiver of service of process, you will agree that there was an expiration of the date of the 1 year limitation between May 2nd and May 30th of the following year. In other words, it would fall within the dismissal rule.
If the court makes that determination, yes. And that was what was argued before the district court, is that by making that determination, there's prejudice to Mayo because there was this ongoing debate between the parties about commencement before actual commencement occurred with a motion to dismiss to try and invoke that rule 104 to avoid liability. I think it's worth noting that at summary judgment, Ms. Converse did not complain about the treatment she received. She did not complain about the prices she was charged, never, and never introduced any evidence to that effect. Essentially, at summary judgment, she was relying on the naked allegations of her pleadings, which Minnesota law supports a finding of summary judgment in that instance. And like I mentioned, Mayo demonstrated to the court through its evidence that there was a contract and that there was a way for the court to be able to determine that that express contract referenced the prices and there was no hiding of the ball. This was an amount that would ultimately be due for the treatment that she was to receive. And she received the treatment, but did not make payment. I see my time has
right. Expired, and you were given a few minutes extra too, as Mr. Wilcox was. So I think, let me thank you. Any other questions from either judge? All right, very good. Mr. Wilcox, you may begin your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try and keep this brief. I want to raise a couple issues in response to what Mr. Hansen has said. First, the idea that my client did not raise an issue with respect to the pricing on the summary judgment motion is just incorrect. I acknowledge that my client didn't present evidence of the reasonableness of the pricing at the summary judgment hearing, and would note that when I submitted a Rule 56 affidavit, that was in part based on the fact that I had reached out to the insurance plan to obtain information to assist me in responding to summary judgment. At that time, it was the onset of the pandemic, and Ohio was hit particularly hard, and I didn't receive responses to the requests I sent them. And so my client, if the court decides to remand this issue, my client intends to present evidence related to the reasonableness. And in my view, the fact that my client was relying on the statements in the complaint based on her position with respect to the reasonableness is no different than Mayo Clinic's affidavit, where they're saying that all they say is that the pricing is reasonable. So in my view, that's an issue that should be left for trial if the court decides to remand based on that issue. The other thing that I would say is the fact that the court granted relief under both theory of contract and equitable relief is, I don't understand how that happened here. There's no explanation for the court from the court for why it made a determination to do so. But I don't think the conclusion we can draw from the order that was entered is that it did so because the amounts charged were reasonable. And so
can
I think,
ask you this? I want to go back to the procedural issue. Why wouldn't your client just sign an acknowledgement if there was, in fact, a waiver of service of process anyway, by virtue of the answer?
So there was you're talking about that at the outset of the case, correct, Your Honor?
Yes.
Well, the issue, I think, was the exact, we know the date that's on the complaint that we received. The exact mailing, the exact date of receipt for my client was unclear. And so what we did is we served the answer and we agreed to acknowledge service in a separate waiver. It just wouldn't have been a waiver under 405 within the 20 days of the mailing of the complaint. And so I think that's one other potential issue here is, you know, the tight turnaround is effectively designed to ensure that the plaintiff can proceed with service of process and recoup those costs if they decide to do so. And here there was just a little bit of delay that meant that we couldn't do it. And then additionally, we thought the Rule 12 waiver was sufficient.
But doesn't it, I mean, by proceeding in the manner that you did in this case, doesn't that basically emasculate the whole rule under 4.05 that you have to sign an acknowledgement and that otherwise it's ineffective?
Well, I don't think,
I mean,
so,
I
because
I don't know what use there'd be for that rule if all you had to do was just file an answer, a late answer.
Well, so I think the issue there, Your Honor, is that yes, there's tight timelines within the rule, but if you look at what the rule was designed to do, it's designed to permit the plaintiff to proceed. And everything we did here was consistent with that purpose. And in an instance where an answer preserves some sort of other jurisdictional defect, then, you know, you'd have a need for acknowledging service. But here, we waived any jurisdictional defect. So I'm not sure that the rule is undercut at all.
All right. Would it be your position then that upon service of that answer, that was in effect the commencement of the action then?
Yes, Your Honor. And I fully acknowledge that under Rule 12, there's a little bit of a hiccup that relates to the ability to amend the pleadings under Rule 15. I don't think that's implicated here based on the representations that we made to the plaintiffs about executing a waiver, albeit a waiver that would have been outside the time constraints of Rule
401. Can you direct us to any case that would say that the action commences upon the service of an answer waiving service of process?
I cannot, Your Honor. That's my proposal for my client's proposal for how we resolve the issue and potential conflict between Rule 12 and Rule 405. If I may just conclude. Thank you. We respectfully ask that the court reverse the district court's order denying my client's motion to dismiss and reverse on summary judgment, or in the alternative, reverse on summary judgment and remand for a trial on the merits so we can determine the reasonableness of plaintiff's fees.
And either judge, do you have any further questions? All right, very good. Thank you. It was well briefed and argued. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you, Your Honors.